Welcome to The Freedom Line, the podcast for the Center for Individual Freedom, where we meet nonsense with common sense. Here's your host, Renee Giacchino.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Freedom Cast. My name is Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. And it is my lucky day. It's my lucky day because I get to welcome back to the program Sherman Tiger Joyce. He's the president of the American Tort Reform Association. But equally as lucky, it is in fact the day that they just released the Trial Lawyer Playbook. That is the Trial Lawyer Playbook put out by the American Tort Reform Association. So what a timely interview. Tiger, thank you again for joining me today.
Thanks, Renee. Great to be with you.
So we had planned to talk a lot, and we will, about third-party litigation funding. But I want to shift first. I know that that is, you know, one of the pillars that you write about in this hot-off-the-press released report on Trial Lawyer Playbook that the listeners can find at atra.org, atra.org. Let's start with the report. Give us a little bit of history on this, and then maybe we can dive a little bit into the Trial Lawyer Playbook.
Sure. Thank you. Well, and again, thank you for letting me join you and your listeners today. I think the easiest way to understand what we think the trial, what we call the Trial Lawyer Playbook, is to look at it from the from a business standpoint. And I think that probably there are aspects of what I'm going to say, which probably all your listeners are somewhat familiar with. But what we do is we connect the dots and how this translates into what the mass torts machine, is another term that we use, is to how plaintiff's lawyers very strategically generate litigation that benefits primarily, candidly, themselves. And I think what the playbook does is it lists the three most important elements. And I'll just sort of highlight them briefly. And then I know we want to delve into them and maybe one or more of them in some detail. Probably the first one, and this is the order that we present them, is what you call third-party litigation financing. Now, Renee, you know me, I've been around a while. I went to law school many, many years ago, and the notion that you could have outside funders engaged in litigation, having an active role, or sometimes even having an active interest in the outcome of litigation would have been alien not that many years ago. The legal profession maintained something called champerty and maintenance, which meant that, you know, the only interested parties that can have a role and an engagement in litigation are the actual party. And the lawyers representing each side owed a responsibility and a duty of loyalty ethically to their respective parties. That way you don't get sidetracked into the considerations of other entities or others who might have a stake in the case. And litigation financing, I think, has arisen in recent times because, like many things, there are always opportunities to look for a return on investment. And litigation, in multiple ways, has become, in effect, an asset class. I think most lawyers think, and I think most people who are not lawyers think, that litigation is the legal process. But for some, it has become a way to make money as an investment. Hedge funds are investing in litigation. They are providing capital to these plaintiffs' firms, and in some instances, they're making money available on what otherwise looks like a loan to individuals who are waiting either for an insurance settlement or the outcome of a particular case. Somebody who might have been injured on the job, somebody who might have suffered, say, a slip and fall or been in an auto accident, who needs legitimately to make up for his or her lost wages and the expenses that he or she has accumulated. So I think it's important to think about it from that perspective. It starts out with this fundamental change in litigation, which is the encroachment of financial interests into what were otherwise claims and matters that involve individuals, entities in legal matters, you know, plaintiff A versus defendant B type of situation. So that's the first, and we can talk a little bit about some of the details. One of the more interesting ones that we're seeing that's come up, I think, that has really attracted a lot of attention is the involvement of foreign sovereign wealth funds. The idea that the investment arms of some of these foreign nations can actually provide capital to these hedge funds, which again invest in litigation, perhaps gives our adversaries an ability to influence litigation or generate litigation, which is oftentimes what happens here. And there's actually important legislation that was introduced on a bipartisan basis by Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana and Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. I think that there's maybe a House bill coming up too. I have to give credit to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Their Institute for Legal Reform issued a great report on this, which really lays it out in a lot of detail. But I think you look at this as sort of part of a broader picture of what's happening and what's going on in this sort of mass torts world. And when I say when I use the term mass torts, most people are familiar with this mainly because of the advertising that they see on television. Have you or a loved one of yours been injured by exposure to talcum powder or exposure to Roundup, the herbicide? We're seeing any number of these sort of mass tort cases where, and I get sort of to the second part of the playbook, which is this advertising strategy. And advertising becomes the process by which what we call lead generators, which are these middlemen intermediaries that accumulate people who have indicated that, hey, I may have a claim, or a loved one of mine may have a claim. So it's just data collection on not making evaluations of individual cases, but sort of accumulating these cases, and then they then sell the information to plaintiffs' lawyers, these firms that engage in these multi-district lawsuits or class action. And I think it's important, as we've learned over time, that it's the litigation funders, the financiers, who are actually oftentimes providing the capital for this advertising. We see them on TV, hear them on the radio. It's more and more that we're starting to see in terms of recruitment of potential claimants online. And so that's really sort of the second leg of what we call the trial lawyer playbook. And then the third is more of a definitive legal issue, and that's expert evidence, or as we call junk science, and the introduction of what we believe is not generally accepted scientific or technical theory. If I come into a court and say that the world is flat, well, I have no business being an expert talking about the dimensions of the globe. And a judge properly should, and under Supreme Court precedent and most state courts, has a responsibility to police the expert evidence that comes in. And it's important because on very technical, scientific, medical matters, most of us don't have that expertise. And when one goes to court, you're not a typical witness in a case, either for or against the plaintiff or the defendant, is generally, except in limited circumstances, not allowed to offer opinion. It's only facts. It's only what transpired. How did this take place? What did you see? As opposed to, was this person breaking the law, or was this, did A cause B? Those are judgment calls that judges have to police under our system. And to illustrate why this is important, again, maybe even a bit more than you suggested with the release of our report. Earlier this week, there was a decision out of a New Jersey appellate court that took an appeal from an award of nearly $224 million at trial in a case involving talcum powder, which is one of the major litigation areas that we're seeing in this arena. The appellate court looked at the process by which the expert testimony came in and determined that it never should have come in. The trial judge never went through the process of determining if the expert evidence being offered by the plaintiff's experts was based on general accepted scientific principles. In fact, as it turned out, two of the experts in this case had previously been determined not to be offering generally accepted scientific expert. But when you see the impact that this has, it's so pivotal in a case like a talc litigation case, in a Roundup case, any number of these sort of mass tort cases. So what we see is a process, if you take a step back and look at these three elements. The plaintiff's lawyers utilize the capital from litigation financing. They and the various, as they call lead generators, generate a number of claimants through advertising, and then you have these experts that offer opinions that are generally not scientifically acceptable. And I think the nearly $224 million award in a case that actually would have been much higher, even the trial judge reduced it significantly. It shows how pivotal, once you get to a trial, if and when you get to a trial, that expert evidence issue is. So that's a lot to get your arms around, but we wanted to put this in a single place and explain it in the context of how this develops and carries out what we call these mass tort cases, the so-called mass tort machine. But this is, as we call it, the playbook of the plaintiff's lawyers.
Our guest is Tiger Joyce. He's the president of the American Tort Reform Association. We are talking about the mass tort machine that's been exposed by ATRA's Trial Lawyer Playbook Report that you can find released just today at ATRA.org. I want to back up just a second, and let's go back to, if we may, that first pillar. Talk a little bit more about TPLF, the third-party litigation financing. And you referenced something that, you know, as a fellow lawyer, immediately as I was reading, particularly the letter of testimony that ATRA submitted recently to the House Committee on Oversight and Reform when they were looking at, you know, unsuitable litigation, the oversight of third-party litigation funding, you raise the issue of how, you know, these TPLF groups, folks like Buford Capital, compromise the lawyer's independence. Why aren't we seeing, Tiger, ethics violations, conflict of interest cases coming about through these? I mean, you lay out, your organization lays out in black and white. I mean, there's no gray zone where in some instances, these financiers, as you call them appropriately, have a say in what's happening with this litigation. And that is just so against, as you mentioned, everything we learned about in law school, where it is between the plaintiff and the defendant. And there should not be another party. In fact, you know, the laws seem pretty clear, at least from an ethical standpoint and conflict of interest, that there should not be another party. And then you wrap into that the fact that there's no transparency, that oftentimes the jury, maybe even the judge, doesn't know that there's this financier in the background, this puppeteer, I'll call him, you know, trying to discourage a settlement or push for something different. Where are these lawsuits or these ethical violation, you know, reports? Why aren't they happening?
Well, I think you've raised two important questions, and I guess one of them is sort of a broader question about, you know, whether, you know, what sort of oversight there might be. And I think that's probably a whole separate topic. I mean, I think we could highlight over the years a variety of different scenarios where, you know, the engagement of the of external parties, third parties, so forth, having a role or the activities of certain members of the bar. But I think you put your finger on really what really has to happen in the near term, and that's transparency. And you know, as we point out in the report, it's largely unknown in most instances to the judge and to all involved. And I think it, you know, again, I think there are broader questions as we highlight in our report. When you start to see the erosion of the responsibility or the obligation of lawyers to his or her client with just the introduction of these funding arrangements, it puts you on a path that has sort of a lot, you know, you think there's kind of a logical outcome, which is that it's that, you know, that what you and I would agree is the responsibility of the lawyer to his or her client, you know, is weakened. But at the very least, it should be at least disclosed. Oftentimes, as I'm sure you know and listeners know, you know, insurance coverage is the kind of matter that often comes out, you know, during the process. And you know, why is the presence of a litigation funder not in the same situation? I think a recent case involving, I think it's Cisco, the food processor, went and borrowed a lot of money to bring antitrust cases against a lot of the food, their clients and alleged violations of the antitrust law. Well, then they got to a point where they wanted to settle some of these cases, but the litigation funders, you know, had a different view. I think this has been in the media. So I think it really illustrates that fundamental problem. But I think the key in the near term is to look at the whole question of transparency and whether it's the presence of sovereign wealth funds. Again, the chamber report and the perspective of Senators Kennedy and Manchin, you know, highlighting that. I mean, if you wanted to sort of be a master manipulator of the American economy, or certainly segments of it, you know, provide the capital to sue targeted industries or businesses. That seems to me that might be pretty attractive. And when you look at the return on investment that these firms are talking about, it becomes an even more significant problem. I think for all of us, we should all agree about that. We should not be allowing that to take place.
And we'll be watching that, Protecting Our Courts from Foreign Manipulation Act, and seeing what's happening with that. Now, let's say I'm a listener home sitting on my sofa, and I'm thinking, and none of this really applies to me. I haven't used this talc. I didn't use Roundup. I don't, you know, they're, you know, maybe just feel that, okay, this is a conversation, you know, I'm not truly, you know, invested in. But let's back that out a little bit and talk about, you know, the trickle-down effect that these types of situations, these third-party litigation financing, the three pillars altogether have. A, starting with, you know, what effect do these types of cases have on flooding the courts? And then I know that in your recently released report, the Trial Lawyer Playbook report, you talk about the cost output both in dollars and in jobs, what is sometimes also referred to as tort taxes. Can you break those down for us a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think first and foremost, you know, we've seen and in fact, the advisory committee of the federal courts is looking at some proposals on what's called multi-district litigation. A lot of these mass tort cases end up in these multi-district lawsuits, which is in the federal courts. And the data here are really quite remarkable. The reality is that, well, this was a procedural process that was established a little over 50 years ago, and it was meant to be a matter of judicial efficiency. But in 2020, so let's just say 50 years later or thereabouts, more than half of the actual federal court cases were these multi-district lawsuits, which you can think of as a shorthand for these, a lot of these sort of mass tort cases. And as of the end of 2022, nearly three quarters of all federal lawsuits. So what does that mean? Well, number one, it imposes an enormous burden on the federal courts. I happen to know a few federal judges, you know, if you talk to them privately, they'll say it's flooding their docket. You know, these cases that may be on the docket one day and taken off, but somebody, you know, has to handle these MDL cases when they're totaled up. It's becoming sort of the tail wagging the dog. And, you know, our federal courts don't exist for that purpose. You know, our federal courts are limited jurisdiction, as you know. They deal with federal statutes and constitutional issues. But instead, you see their dockets just being absolutely jammed. And I think that's really, really important to understand. So now, the typical sort of person listening to this probably doesn't have the proverbial federal case that would go to federal court. But we all have a stake in the appropriate operation and smooth processes and efficient processes for our for our federal courts. And this is becoming a serious problem. The fact, as I said, that this advisory committee starting to look into this changes, I think, gets at the problem. And I think one of the things that the court's going to have to wrestle with is the fact that so many of the cases that are generated through these ads financed by the capital from these litigation financial organizations or firms as I said, it's jamming up the courts and making it more and more difficult, you know, for them to operate smoothly. So I just think it's very, very important for the average person. You want the courts to work properly, but this has become kind of probably the most significant problem that we've identified. And so the bottom line is that, and we cite reports from the Perriman Group that hundreds of, you know, the cost of our legal system just continues to go up. We can break this down by state. We can break it down. We've seen evidence, on a national basis. But the reality is, wherever you live, the excesses and the costs and the abuses do total up. And they impact us both in terms of the cumulative impact on the economy. It's taking the economic outputs. And this is not, now I have to be clear to say, it's not to say we can't have or shouldn't have a civil justice system. The question is, what about the abuses and what are the impacts? And we've seen plenty of instances where the reality is that this is costing jobs. The impact is on the tax base for states. The reality is, we highlight things, an annual tort tax. I think we highlight in California, New York, and Illinois for an individual is over $2,100 in California, to over $2,000 in New York, and nearly $1,700 in Illinois. And those are some of the worst. Those are the most significant examples. That's just the cost that you have because of the excesses of the system. It also deals with jobs, the lack of jobs or jobs not created. And as I said, it impacts the tax base. So it really does affect. Think to all your listeners, the reality is that the legal system impacts your lives, and having a properly balanced and efficient system really is important.
What shocks me as well, I mean, most of this is shocking, but something else that you highlight, or that is highlighted in ATRA's report that was just released, the Mass Tort Machine Exposed by Trial Lawyer Playbook report, it's not just the cost in jobs, not just the cost in, you know, what it's costing us as taxpayers, the burden on our federal courts, but lives have been lost. And some of this, quite frankly, by what I would seriously call false advertising. That second pillar that we've talked about, the advertising strategy, you know, put out by these lead generators, and then they're spewing this junk science in these mass tort cases. And you expose instances where, you know, someone's seeing this television commercial, believes it to be true that they should stop taking this blood thinner immediately and call this law firm, and they do, and, you know, there's a death as a result of it. I don't understand how, you know, certain advertising, you know, you've got to verify that what you're putting up on television, on the radio, is accurate and true, but doesn't seem to have to be the case with some of these, you know, lead generators and the advertising that they're doing. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we've seen examples. I think you mentioned some of the blood thinners. You know, I think we've seen actual data coming from the federal government about people who have died as a result of, I think the numbers are, you know, 50 or so people that they identify. This was a few years ago. You have to figure that's a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. When you see these ads, particularly, well, obviously we're talking about the pharmaceutical product. If you sort of get the sort of somber, sort of drums of war type of background and, you know, suggestions in these ads, that these medications are dangerous, and that if you're taking them, you're at risk. The reality is that the danger is not to follow your doctor's guidance. I think we should all sort of agree about that. And, you know, I think one of the difficulties, Renee, at least in theory, if a law firm issued an ad, ran an ad like that, there would be the potential for, the state bar, or, you know, the licensing, authority in the bar in one or more states to take action. But oftentimes these ads are run by these so-called lead generators, which are not lawyers. They're not legal entities. And so I think that creates a problem. Having said that, state attorneys general, public health officials should certainly be concerned about those. And I think there have been some states that have taken up some reform legislation on that topic. It continues to be a problem. But I think that really gets to the heart of, you know, what is really at stake here? Are these entities really looking out for the interest of consumers, or are they really just looking to be part of this machine, as we call it, this mass torts machine through the trial lawyer playbook and dealing with that? But I think it all starts with doing what you just did, which is identifying and recognizing that there's a problem. There may be some restrictions on what types of reforms can be established about commercial advertising, but at the very least, it's an important issue that the appropriate officials should take up.
So I see kind of three pillars that I want to add, and that is we need to be talking about this, we need to advocate for transparency, and they need to be truthful in whatever it is that they're doing. So, you know, I think to sum things up, Tiger, our guest today, Tiger Joyce, president of the American Tort Reform Association. Follow Tiger and the work of his organization at ATRA.org. That's where you can go to read the hot off the press trial lawyer playbook report that they did, as well as a letter of testimony submitted before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform on this exact issue, the issue of third-party litigation financing or funding. Tiger, before I let you go, I like to close out our interviews by giving you an opportunity. Is there anything else that you'd like to inform us about, educate us on before we end our conversation today?
No, Renee, you really touched on, I think, the key points, but I did want to just emphasize a point, and that's really what we started out talking about. And I think it's important, to avoid some of even more profound challenges and problems, to make sure that whether it's just the bar, public officials, elected officials, you know, that we maintain that core principle of the responsibility of lawyers to their client, whether it's on the plaintiff side or the defendant side. I think something I probably failed to mention that's in our report is, you know, Arizona Supreme Court recently decided that outside entities can purchase law firms. When law firms become they are the vehicle for representation, and when they become an asset class, as litigation has become one, I think that's quite problematic as well. So that when I think back to one of the comments that, you know, that we've each made, is your listeners should recognize that while that may not directly affect their professional lives, that anything that creates further erosion in that sort of core principle of the duty of the ethical responsibility of lawyers to their clients is a problem, and it should be. Everyone has an interest in ensuring that doesn't take place or doesn't erode further.
Definitely a slippery slope. Well, thank you again, Tiger Joyce, our guest, president of the American Tort Reform Association. We greatly appreciate all of your time today, the work that you have done and your organization has done in this arena to help identify, you know, a huge issue and bring it to the forefront, you know, as you mentioned, both to the public, to public officials, to elected officials. You know, let's try to see if we can turn this ship around before it's too late, if that hasn't already happened. Thank you again for your time. We look forward to having you join us again soon.
Thank you so much, Renee. Great to be with you again.